Hebrews chapter 9, as the author of Hebrews is laying out what happened on the Day of Atonement, it feels like he gets something wrong. Well, let's just go there. Look at Hebrews chapter 9. We won't belabor this point too much, but I think this is significant. He talks about, I'll start chapter 9, verse 1. He says, "Now even the first covenant had regulations for worship in an earthly place of holiness, that is, the tabernacle. For a tent was prepared, the first section in which were the lampstand and the table and the bread of presence." Table and the bread of presence. It is called the holy place. So he says, in how he's laying out the tabernacle, how he's laying out the furniture in the tabernacle, he says, once you go into the holy place, he says there were two pieces of furniture there. Two pieces of furniture. The candlestick, which isn't actually, it's the lampstand and the table with showbread on it, or the table with the bread of the presence. Those were the two things, he says, were in the outer section. Well, if you look at any depiction of the temple or tabernacle, you will see three pieces of furniture in the outer section. You'll see three pieces of furniture. You'll see the lampstand, you'll see the table of the bread of the presence, and you will see the altar of incense. You'll see the altar of incense. Why then does the author of Hebrews say there are only two? Let's continue reading. Then he says, behind the second curtain was the second section called the most holy place, having the golden altar of incense and the ark of the covenant covered on all sides with gold, which was a golden urn holding a manna and an Aaron's staff and that had budded in the tablets of the covenant. So he says, then once you get past the veil, once you get in there, then you had the altar of incense, and then you had the Ark of the Covenant with the mercy seat on top. So did he get it wrong? Did he get it wrong? No. He didn't get it wrong, because if you read, which we're not going to, if you've been on Thursday mornings at 6:30, it's not that hard to get up. I get up at 4:45 every Thursday morning. You can do this. If you'd come and meet with us, you would understand exactly what he's talking about. And chapter 9 of Hebrews is clearly a Day of Atonement reference. It's in the context of the Day of Atonement. And I think there's something significant as you get to this depiction of the Day of Atonement. I think that on the day of the Day of Atonement, it was actually set up, the tabernacle was actually set up in a different way. It was set up with two pieces on the outside and one piece and two pieces on the inside of the veil. And as we walk through that, I think you'll see it displayed. I spent at least a week trying to work through that and say, okay, so did he get it wrong? I'm not one just to say, okay, well, it doesn't make any sense, but let's believe it anyway. I'm not want to do that, but I want to figure out what's going on here. I think it's an easy figure out. If you just read Leviticus 16, it tells you exactly what happens on the Day of Atonement. On the Day of Atonement, everything is set up differently. It's set up differently. And someone might say, well, how did they do that? How did they get in there? Well, that's what the Levites did. If you remember what the Levites did, the Levites put together the tabernacle as they carried it around. It was a mobile kind of thing. It's not hard to think that they could have intentionally moved a piece of furniture inside that veil for that day. And I think that's exactly what happens as we walk through what happens. So we have the prohibition, and now we have, here's then how you do it. Here's then how you do the Day of Atonement. And this is a big deal, again, because it represented atonement for, and we'll talk about, Ray actually taught a whole Sunday school lesson on atonement a while back, but it represented atonement for the high priest, for his family, which means the priests, the high priest, all the priests, and all the people. So this was atonement. Do you remember what atonement means? What does atonement mean? A covering. It means a covering. It was the day of, the Jewish holiday for the Day of Atonement is Yom Kippur or Yom Kippur. That's the reason. Now, why do some people spell Kippur with an E and some people spell Kippur with a U? Because there are no vowels in Hebrew. It's just consonants. It's just consonants. So nobody's wrong. It's just that's the way it is. So, and the word Kippur has the idea of of somehow attempting to make reconciliation, but it's done through a covering of blood. So everything that happened on the Day of Atonement was this sprinkling of and this covering of blood that represented a covering or a covering of sin, but not a purification for sin, not taking it away. It never took it away. Only one sacrifice ever took away sin. If you continue reading Hebrews chapter 9, as you get to verse, I think, 7, 8, or later, it says that all these things, all these rituals that were done, this offering of boats, this offering of goats and bulls, this offering never, never provided perfection of the conscience of the worshiper. It never did that. All it ever did was provide a ritual kind of cleansing. It made the outside clean, but the inside remained dirty. And then you get Hebrews 9, 10 through 14, which if you're on Thursday mornings, you know this is the key. That key paragraph of Hebrews is Hebrews 9, 10 through 14, where he says, "But the blood of Jesus' sacrifice makes pure the conscience." Makes pure the conscience. Something that this ritualistic system could never do. There's a big difference. So what's happening here is not some kind of taking sin away. It's not some kind of washing clean of sin. That's not going to happen until Jesus' sacrifice on the cross 1,000 years, 1,500 years after this time. That's not going to happen. But it is this sacrifice, this atonement points to that. Looks forward to that happening. So it is a very significant day in the people of Israel, for the people, and it was one of those days when all of Israel was to come. All of Israel was to be there, and all of Israel was to watch this happen and see this happen. So the first thing that Aaron did was he made himself ready. They brought first the bull and the rams. They brought those, but they didn't sacrifice them yet. They just got them ready to a place where they would be ready for the sacrifice. Once they got them there ready for sacrifice, then Aaron would make himself ready. So the first step in the Day of Atonement is for Aaron to make himself ready. It says, starting in verse 4, "He shall put on the linen, holy linen coat, shall have the linen undergarment on his body. He shall then tie the linen sash around his waist, wear the linen turban. These are the holy garments. He shall bathe his body in water and then put them on, and he shall take from the congregation of the people 2 male goats." So the first thing Aaron has to do is make sure that he himself is ready. He bathes with water. And I don't think it's just any water he finds. I think this is red heifer water that he bathes with. I think this is water that has had the red heifer ashes in it. We'll get to red heifer. We're not there yet. But the red heifer was a special deal. We're going to talk about it a little bit. So this is why it takes me forever to get through anything, because you got to build the whole case, right? So the red heifer is this special heifer that was, I don't know how they bred this heifer. I don't know what happened. Vince may be able to tell us if he's ever seen a red heifer. As far as we know, only 6 red heifers were killed throughout the entire history of Israel. Only 6 red heifers. So what they would do is they would take this red heifer and they would burn it outside the tent, outside the tabernacle, outside the camp. They would burn it. Then they would take its ashes and they would store its ashes in an urn type deal. And then they would use those ashes, and every once in a while they would sprinkle some of those ashes in water. And that would become, in some sense, not the Catholic sense, but it would become holy water. It would become water that was made to sprinkle on things and sprinkle on people to make them ritually clean, to make them ritually pure. They would get sprinkled with this water. The tabernacle, as it's dedicated, it is sprinkled with the water. If someone has like spots for leprosy or something like that, and they would come back, then they would be sprinkled with some of this water. You didn't take an entire bath in the water necessarily. It was more for sprinkling. But Aaron was to take, he was to bathe completely, to completely wash the outside of himself, and then put on all of the linen garments that he was supposed to put on. He was supposed to dress up in all the finery of the high priest so that he was ready to go in. It's interesting. Most days Aaron didn't do that. This day Aaron did that. Most days, Aaron stood before the entire congregation without doing that. This day, he stood only before the Lord in his full getup. This is a big day. this is a big day. He had the turban on. I think remember what the gold plate on the turban says? Holiness to the Lord. Good job, Art. The gold plate on the turban says holiness to the Lord. And I think that's there for a purpose, so that when the presence of God saw Aaron stand, he would see this man standing here in the very presence of God is separated unto God. He is sanctified to service. He is only here because he's serving God. That's a big deal. That's the first thing. That's what's dedicated there, as that holiness for the Lord plate is seen there by God. So now we have Aaron ready. Aaron is made ready, and now we have the actual sacrifices that are going to take place. Verse 5, he shall take from the congregation of the people of Israel two male goats for a sin offering and one ram for a burnt offering. So the next thing that's done is there are two goats taken and one ram taken. And they're not Aaron's goats. They're not Aaron's rams. This sets this sacrifice apart from the other sacrifices. If you had a sin offering you were going to make, if you recognized you had committed an unintentional sin and you needed to deal with that unintentional sin the way God prescribed in the law, then you would go to your flock and you would pick one of your lambs and you would bring one of your lambs unblemished to offer as a sacrifice. If you couldn't afford your lamb or a lamb that was yours, then you would offer, you would bring a pigeon or a turtle dove or something that you could afford. And if you couldn't even afford that, then you would bring some really nice grain, and it would offer grain in its place. So that's not what's going on here. This isn't Aaron offering it for himself. This is Aaron taking from the congregation this ram and these two goats. This is Aaron taking it from them. So this was a representative. This act is going to be representative of for all the people, not just for a single person or a single family. It's for everyone, all of the congregation of Israel, because that's where the things came from. So he takes those, and he also, if you go back, he also took a bull. And so the next thing Aaron does after he gets a bull and a ram, and now he gets this ram and two goats, now he offers the bull as a sin offering for himself, and he shall make atonement for himself and all his house. So I think this is kind of just a summary statement of what's going to happen. And then as we get down to verse 11 is actually the actual walkthrough how it happens. So we get a summary here in from verse 6 to verse 10, and then we get the exact how it happens in verse 10, 11, and following. So the summary statement is this: he takes the bull, and he offers the bull for a sin offering to make atonement for, to give covering for himself and his house. Then he takes the two goats, and he doesn't offer both of them. He doesn't offer both of them. There's lots cast over these two goats. One of those goats is going to be chosen as a sin offering. One of those goats is going to be chosen as the Azazel. The Azazel. There is no English translation for that word Azazel, right? Your translation may say scapegoat. It might. That's actually, this is where we get the term scapegoat from. The term scapegoat comes from this section of Scripture, because what happens then is this one goat would represent the sins of the people. Aaron then would take his hands. The one that got the bad news is going to be killed. It's going to become a sacrifice. It's going to be burned. Its blood's going to be sprinkled. It's not going to be a good day for that goat. Okay, this other goat, it's supposedly going to have a really good day. Life is going to get good for it, because what Aaron is going to do then is Aaron is going to take his hands and symbolically then put the sins of Aaron and put the sins of the people onto this Azazel, or this scapegoat. And then that goat was to be driven out of the camp and set free. It was to be driven out of the camp and set free, symbolizing that the sins of the people would be taken by some other thing and taken away from the people, away from the camp, away from Israel. And that's really good. Well, what Israel began to do, historically, we know this is a fact, is they didn't want that goat coming back. You know, you send your sin away, You don't want that sin walking back into the camp. So what they started doing was they would actually take that goat and, you know, pretend, oh, it's running away. And they would actually follow the goat in the wilderness. They would find the goat, break its neck, and throw it over a cliff so they would never come back. So it wasn't really a good day for that goat either. It was supposed to be, but it ended up not being a great day. So there is the goat for the sin offering, and there is the goat that was supposed to be the Azazel or the scapegoat. So that's what's supposed to happen. He's supposed to be presented alive. Look at verse 10. He's supposed to be presented alive before the Lord to make atonement over it, that it may be sent away into the wilderness to Azazel. So to be sent away, and that is to carry the sin, to be the scapegoat. That's what was being talked about there. So that's the summary, and here's actually the walkthrough how he does it. So now Aaron then takes the bull as a sin offering, and he makes atonement for himself, for his house. Again, that ties in the same exact word that's used back up there in verse 6. Same exact wording. He kills the bull as a sin offering himself, and then he takes a censer full of coals from the altar before the Lord, and two handfuls of sweet incense, beaten small, and then he brings it inside the veil. So here's what he does. There's the killing of the bull. He takes some of the blood, okay, and then he takes an incense, and from the altar that's outside the even the holy place, the altar's outside, he goes and he gets coals from that altar, and he puts it inside the censer. The censer is not the table of incense, altar of incense. That was like a box. It was a 3-foot by 3-foot box that you would have to carry around. So it's not like he's taking coals from the altar, putting it onto the altar of incense, and now carrying that around with him as he walks into the... That's not what's going on here. He has a censer. So there's a little... And I don't, you know, my automatically I go to like the Catholic deal where they got the little thing on a chain and they... You know, they're waving that around. I don't know if it was a little thing on a chain or not. I do know that a lot of Catholic symbolism is based in the Israelite priesthood. I do know that for a fact. That's why they call themselves priests. That's why they do a lot of the stuff they do. But I don't think necessarily it looked like that. But anyhow, however it is, he has in a censer, he has coals from the altar. Then he takes two tablespoons, or he takes two measures of the incense that they made. That was prescribed earlier. Back in Exodus, the prescription for the incense was given very specifically. It was a very specific mix of incense. So he puts that incense into the censer with the coal. So now you start to get the smell. You start to get it going in. Okay? That's what's happened so far. Then he goes, and then here's the big deal. He shall bring it inside the veil. He'll bring it inside the veil. So he now has done everything outside. He walks in through the holy place and goes inside the veil of the Holy of Holies. So where is Aaron now? Aaron is inside the Holy of Holies, inside the most holy place, beyond the veil. What does it say he does next? He puts the incense on the fire before the Lord. How is there fire before the Lord inside the Holy of Holies if there's no altar of incense in there? How is that happen? It can't happen. There's got to be a place for fire to be inside the Holy of Holies for there to be a fire inside the Holy of Holies. So that's why I suggest that it appears to me that at least on the Day of Atonement, the tabernacle was set up differently than every other day. And it makes sense. This was a day unlike any other day. This was a day that was the only day of the entire year that was this day. So I think it was set up different. Every other day, the prayers, What does the altar of incense, what does it represent? What is the incense? What is that smoke? What is that smoke coming from the altar represent? It represents the prayers of the people. And we know that at least in the temple, we know the altar of incense is outside the veil. How do we know that? We know that from the story of Zacharias in the New Testament, right? Zacharias is a priest. He is not the high priest. He is a priest. And what is Zacharias doing What is he doing when he enters into the holy place to do the thing he's going to do when the angel of the Lord appears to him? What is he doing? He's tending the altar of incense. It's very significant. As he's tending the altar of incense, what does the angel say to him? Zacharias, your prayers have been answered. Oh, what a coincidence. He's offering altar of incense and his prayers have been answered. That's not a coincidence. That's very significant because that's what it represents. And again, in that day, at that point, the altar of incense is outside the veil, not inside the holy place. So I think there's a different setup here. So I don't think our author of Hebrews got it wrong. I think he's definitely in a Day of Atonement mode as he's writing Hebrews, and Hebrews chapter 9 specifically. Come to Thursday morning, you would have heard that case made beautifully, by the way. but I'm not going to make it now. So he goes and he takes the incense in and he puts it on the altar. So now what's bathing the entire area inside the Holy of Holy place is the presence of God, the mercy seat, and this smoke representing the prayers of the people. Prayers of the people on the other days, I think, represented relationship. I think prayers on this day represented repentance. I think they represented brokenness over sin. I think that was what Israel was supposed to do that day. And so I think that's what's going on. So next thing he does, and the reason he does that is so that the smoke can then cover, the smoke and incense can cover the mercy seat so that Aaron doesn't die. So Aaron doesn't die. Well, it's really bad. If you got a veil in the middle and you put the smoke outside and the smoke can't get in there, what's going to happen to poor old Aaron every time he walks in? He's dead. So I think the case can be made very well that on the Day of Atonement, at least, the altar of incense was inside the veil. And I think the case can also be made very easily for the every other day the altar of incense was outside the veil. So anyway. Then he takes some of the blood of the bull and sprinkles it with his fingers on the front of the mercy seat. On the east side, from the mercy seat, he just sprinkled some of the blood with his fingers seven times. So he goes east, goes to the east side, and sprinkles blood with his fingers seven times on the mercy seat. Okay? And then I think he comes out. There are some, I think Ron actually thinks he goes in and out four times on that day. I read two. I try to go with Ron, but I read two. I just read two times. Once he goes in with incense and blood of the bull, once he goes in with blood of the ram. So I'm going twice. He comes out, but then he comes out, verse 15, comes out, kills the goat of the sin offering, brings its blood, and does the sprinkling again seven times. And this is now the atonement, this verse 16. Thus he shall make atonement for the holy place because the uncleanness of the people of Israel, because of their transgressions, all their sins. So that's what's going on. Now, it's also very important to recognize that while he's doing that, while Aaron is doing that, no one else can go into the holy place. No one else can go into the tent. Everybody else has to stay out. There is a tradition that is simply a tradition. I don't think it's ever been proven to be true. That the high priest, when he went into the Holy of Holies, would go into the Holy of Holies with a rope tied around his foot so that if he keeled over dead while in there, they could drag him out without going in. That is a neat little story, but that's all that is a neat little story. I can't find any verification that really ever happened. If you understand how the veil was made, it was a zigzag course for the high priest to get in anyway. He would zig this way, get through one layer of the veil, zig that way, go through another, and then finally zig the third way to get into the Holy of Holies. So, I mean, imagine zigging through these curtains with a rope tied to your leg. You're going to get knotted up. It's not going to go very well. So the zigzag makes it probably not there. But also, the folks who were supposed to be listening for the jingle, jingle, jingle had to be not just outside the Holy of Holies. They had to be outside the holy place. They couldn't even be in the room. So they're probably at least 30 feet away from where Aaron is or from where the high priest is trying to hear a Dingle, 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 dingle. I don't know if they would be able to do that or not. Because that's, remember, there are bells tied around the or sewn into the bottom of Aaron's garment. There are those bells. No whistles, but there are bells down there. So some have suggested that's why the bells are down there. That's a suggestion. I'm not yelling at anybody for doing that, but I don't think you'll find it anywhere in Israel's history that that ever happened. They never had to drag the high priest out because he died. If you recall, the high priest always goes in the first time unatoned for, right? He has to go in the first time unatoned for, because what's he doing the first time he goes in? He's making atonement for himself and for his house. So if he walks through unatoned for, and if you walk in unatoned for and you're dead, day of atonement is going to be a really short day. That is going to be a really long day, because he goes through every priest in the business. Okay, let's try this one. Nope, he didn't. Boom. It's not going to work very well. So anyway, that's, I'll leave that one be. So no one could go in to the tent of assembly. Then after it's done, Aaron goes out. And then he sprinkles blood on the altar itself. So not only is the inside sprinkled, but the outside, the altar itself, is also sprinkled. Then let's go to verse 20. And after he's made an end of atoning, so after all the dead sacrifices are done, then he presents the live goat. And this is what Aaron does to the live goat. He lays both hands on the head of the live goat, confess over it all the iniquities of the people of Israel and all their transgressions and all their sins. He shall put his hands on the head of the goat and send it into the wilderness by the hand of the man who is in readiness. So there's a guy waiting. There's a guy who's ready to do this. This is his job, probably a Levite. And after Aaron does this laying on the hands, and I think it's interesting that what Aaron lays on the head of the goat are the transgressions and the iniquities of the people. I think in some sense, these are the intentional sins that are being talked about. These are the transgression. One who has transgressed the law of God gets laid on the goat. It's not covered. Not covered in the atonement. They're covered in the scapegoat. Because these sins can't just be covered, they must be taken away. And I think there's a picture there in the scapegoat of the sins being taken away, the sins going away from the people. And here's what it says, verse, the goat shall bear the iniquities on itself to a remote area and shall be let go free in the wilderness. Again, that was the original plan, but that's not, the Jews like to help God out. And so this is one of the things they chose to help God out by breaking the neck of the scapegoat and throwing it over a cliff so it couldn't come back. They helped God out by building the wall around the law, taking the law and adding 613 more. To that. It's called the Mishnah. If you ever want to see how the Jews helped God out, get a copy of it and read the Mishnah. And just see how hard it was to be a practicing Pharisee. Pharisees, you're really, man, you're proud of yourself. But if you are really a practicing Pharisee and you got it right, you should have been proud of yourself. You should have been. It was hard to be a Pharisee. It wasn't something, I mean, there was a checkbox of how much you gave. There was a checkbox of where you were. There was a checkbox of what friends you had. There's a checkbox of what you did and didn't do on a Sabbath. All these things were checked, and you had to have your phylacteries on. You had to have all this stuff all the time. Being a Pharisee was not easy. It was hard. And if you were a really good Pharisee, that's why Paul says, when he's talking about the things that he could brag about, he says, I'm a Pharisee of the Pharisees. But that is something to be proud of, except it's all it is to be proud of. It doesn't get you anywhere. It doesn't get you anywhere. Because like Jesus said to them, you're like whitewashed sepulchers. You look great on the outside, but inside you're full of dead men's bones. So anyway, they liked helping God out. And one of the ways they helped God out eventually was they started killing the scapegoat. Started killing the scapegoat. After that's all done now, then Aaron shall come into the tent of meeting, take off the linen garments that he put on when we went into the holy place, and he leaves them there. Then he goes and takes a bath again, takes another bath. After he comes out, then he comes back out, offers a burnt offering to make atonement for himself and the people, and then it is the regular, like how you do a sin offering. So So that's the Day of Atonement. That's the Day of Atonement. You can read the rest of the chapter. It was a big day. A big day in Israel. So what do they do now? What do they do now? Is Israel still a nation, right? So what do they have a temple? Can they do a Day of Atonement? No, they can't do that. Actually, what happened during the Babylonian captivity, the Day of Atonement and the sacrificial system got replaced by the synagogue system. The synagogue system, they spiritualized the intent of the sacrificial system. They spiritualized that and made it more about social type help, being, you know, the right kind of people, helping each other socially, those kinds of things, being involved that way. That was what began the synagogue system, and that began in the Babylonian captivity. There were no synagogues before the Babylonian captivity. That was a construct of how Israel did worship in the Babylonian captivity, and that stuck. Even when they rebuilt their temple, they continued to do synagogue worship, as attested to by first century Israel, by the New Testament. Jesus has both synagogue and temple worship at the same time. Guess what? 70 AD, temple's destroyed again. So now they do synagogues. Synagogue is how they accomplish, in their mind, that's how they're accomplishing that thing. How is it really accomplished? Oh, man. It was accomplished by Jesus on the cross, right? All these things didn't accomplish any kind of purification. All those things, all that, Hebrews 9 again, all of that could never provide perfection of the conscience. It wasn't intended to. It was intended to provide ritual cleansing and ritual cleansing only. What perfected the conscience, what purified the conscience, actually verse 14 of Hebrews chapter 9, what purified the conscience was the blood of Jesus, who offered himself once for all, blameless. I mean, you could actually, well, I won't. It took us 5 weeks to get through those four verses on Thursday morning because every one of those words is really, really important, so I won't bore you with that today. So so that is then the Day of Atonement. Any questions, comments, statements regarding Day of Atonement? Put you to sleep completely. Yes, Steve.
They said, you know, Abraham was a kind of righteousness through faith, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do the Jews today believe that there's faith there as part of the synagogue? I'm just curious. I don't know.
That's a good question. Steve's question was, Abraham, even the Jews would recognize Abraham believed God and was counting him of righteousness, right? So do they hold to any kind of a faith? Well, the answer is no and yes. You typically would think I would say yes and no, but the answer is no and yes. You have to get the no in front of the yes, because their no is, it's not about believing and then doing something because of belief. It's about doing something, and then being made righteous by the thing you do so that you can believe. So that's why it's a no and a yes. I would say one of the reasons I say that, and I want to back up what I say here. I want to back it up. The reason I say that is because if you look at first century Christianity, the tension between Jews and Gentiles, the tension for the Jewish Christians were, so what does a Gentile have to do? You have that over and over and over again. In Acts chapter 13, 14, 15, you have this great work of Christ that's going on in the Gentile world, right? And so Paul and Barnabas come back to Jerusalem and they make a report of what has happened. And there's this, what do they do? Does a Gentile believer have to do the Jewish stuff too to believe? Or what do they do? Well, there's a conference held. First council of the church. It's called the Council of Jerusalem. You'll read it in Acts 15. James, the half-brother of Jesus, that James writes a letter and says, here's what a Gentile has to do. Abstain from meat offered to idols. Don't practice sexual immorality. And you're in. No circumcision, nothing like that. Nothing like that. Now, I'm not going to exposit that whole thing right now. I'm not going to teach that whole thing. I could do that, but that would take us another 5 hours. You'd think that would solve it, right? But no, the Jews are still strong on you have to do something. You have to do something. And so by the time you hit Galatians, when Paul's writing the book of Galatians, that's reared itself back up again. It's come back up. The Jews are saying to the Gentiles, you've got to be Jewish. You've got to do these things first. You have to, and Paul is saying, no, you don't. That's not the gospel I preached. That's not the gospel Peter preached at first, and now Peter's preaching this gospel, but I'll let you know, I got in his face about that. And he backed down. He knows what's right. So there's a big deal. By the time you get to Hebrews, that's what the whole book of Hebrews is about. The book of Hebrews is a book written to both Hebrew believers, which are Jewish people, and Hebrew non-believers who are toying with or considering this faith thing. And the whole book of Hebrews is about Jesus is better than all of that. He is superior to all of that. You don't need to do any of that. Now, that's, understand what I'm saying. I'm not saying you can't do any of that, but you don't need to do any of that. Paul actually in Galatians says, I am not under the law. What? You're a Jew. Yeah, but you see, Paul's not under the law because Jesus successfully fulfilled the law for all who would believe completely and 100%. Don't need to do anything else. There's nothing you can add. And in fact, the author of Hebrews is going to say in chapter 10, if you have tasted this, if you have sampled the grace of God, if you've come to a place where in your mind you've understood all the things that, I'm paraphrasing, understood all the things that Christ has provided, and yet you say, but I've got to do these things, then Jesus said, or the author of Hebrews says, there's no sacrifice for you. There's no sacrifice. It won't cut it. And I don't think he's saying you're forever cut off. What he's saying is if you won't take the sacrifice of Jesus, and you don't understand that his sacrifice is complete and total and whole and you need nothing, then nothing else will work for you. Nothing else will work because you can't do it yourself. You can't make yourself clean. So there is this struggle for Jews, and I think still today even, the struggle for Jews to somehow make themselves clean. And I think that's still the effort that's going on for them. So that's why I say no and yes. But the issue is what they struggle with all throughout their history. They took the outside legalistic option of the law. They forgot that first they are supposed to love God, fear God, keep his commandments, value what he said, and then do them. They just stuck with do, which, unfortunately, I think oftentimes that's what we do as well. John? Yep, exactly. Yeah, so that, what John said, just so we get on the tape, is Yom Kippur, if you look at a Hebrew calendar, they don't call it the Day of Atonement, they call it the day. That is the day. That is, for them, it was the day. It was the day that really everything, every inch or inkling of any kind of righteousness centered around a correct application of the Day of Atonement for them. But even then, it never, ever, ever took away sin. All it ever did was cover sin. That's all it ever did. It's Jesus who made purification for sin. It's Jesus who was the propitiating sacrifice. It's Jesus who was the one who totally and completely satisfied the wrath of God and the justice of God in his death for us. Why is it him? Because he's the only one who ever completely and perfectly fulfilled the law. Remember this, and I think this is important for Jesus as he presented himself to the Pharisees. He said to them, I didn't come to abolish the law. I came to fulfill it. So Jesus wasn't saying, no, the law is totally unimportant, just throw it away, forget it. No, Jesus said the law is extremely important, and because you can't, I will. And he did it perfectly for all of those who would believe. He did it perfectly. That's what provides propitiation. That's what provides purification. All of these sacrifices merely pointed to the coming sacrifice of Jesus when he would provide that for all those who would believe. So, good point. What else? Any other? David. Exactly. Yep. That's good. The blood of Christ shed is the basis for God's justice and his righteousness. If he had just winked at sin in the Old Testament, he would not have been just. He would not have been just. But because Jesus' sacrifice happened, God I don't know how you say that word. Forbeared? It can't be forbeared. It must be forbore. God was forbearing the sins of all who sinned prior to that sacrifice based on the blood of Jesus, not just because he said, oh, not a big deal. It was still a very big deal. It was still a very big deal. So, good point. Excellent point. All right, well, it's 9:46, so I should let you go. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for the time together. Thank you for your son giving his blood on a cross for us, providing for us not only ritual cleansing, but purification from all the sin. Thank you for removing our sin as far as the east is from the west. Thank you for taking our sin and burying it at the depths of the deepest sea, that we don't have to worry about a scapegoat walking it back into the camp. Thank you for that love you showed for us in your son on the cross. We just ask that you would encourage us through your word this morning. In your name, amen. You're dismissed. Thanks.